Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 31st of January, these are our main stories. As Brexit hour approaches, the British Prime Minister is set to hail it as the dawn of a new era. We'll look at the mood in London and in Brussels. Also, as the number of coronavirus cases approaches 10,000, the question is raised, could China have acted sooner? And
I was asleep. He came into the house and threw petrol over me. He locked the door from outside. I fainted and fell down, and my face was badly burned.
So should Pakistan do more to help women who are victims of attacks involving fire and acid? Also in this podcast, new hope that cervical cancer might one day be eradicated. And
you can measure the energy field of the body like somewhere between 4 and 6 feet off the body. The body doesn't end right here at the skin. The body is multidimensional.
But does actress Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle series pose a health risk to the public? 1 hour before midnight, GMT today, the UK formally leaves the European Union after 47 years of membership. Brexit will have been activated. There'll be months of intensive negotiations about how the country's close and complex relationship with the EU should be reconstructed. It's the biggest constitutional change in Britain for generations. And to mark the occasion, British flags are flying on the mile leading to Buckingham Palace in London, and new coins have been minted. For the British government, this is what the Cabinet Minister Michael Gove had to say this morning.
Now, we want to have as close as possible a relationship with the EU, and the approach that we want to take is built on the relationship that they have with Canada. Ultimately, no tariffs, no quotas on our trade, but there will be some regulations that will differ in Britain. We will do things in a way which is better for our economy.
The European Commission's president, Ursula von der Leyen, called it an emotional day and warned that nations were weaker on their own.
Our experience has taught us that strength does not lie in splendid isolation, but in our unique union. Nowhere else in the world can you find 27 nations of 440 million people speaking 24 different languages, relying on each other, working together, living together.
Shortly before we recorded this podcast, I found out more about the mood in Brussels with our reporter there, Adam Fleming, and first in London with Rob Watson.
Well, it's a 50-50 split, pretty much, isn't it, Nick? I mean, you have the 52% who voted for Britain to leave the European Union who genuinely see this as exciting, as a chance for a new beginning. But, of course, you see the other half, the 48%, perhaps not as emotionally as during the last 3.5 years, but still being deeply regretful and thinking that this is a move profoundly in the wrong direction.
So what can we expect over the coming hours, and what tone is Boris Johnson going to set?
Well, in a funny way, I think there'll be parallels with what happened in 1973. There wasn't a great deal of fanfare and celebration when Britain joined the European Union in January, 47 years ago. In the same way, there won't be much celebration now. And I think that's for some of the same reasons in 1973, the uncertainty as to what lay ahead. But also because it's a reflection of the bitter division that's been out there those last 3.5 years. And the idea, if I think of any sort of triumphalism or celebration, would be sort of impossible and unwise.
Yeah, we're hearing that Boris Johnson's speech an hour before that Brexit deadline, he's going to be talking about the dawn of a new era, but this is a moment of real national renewal and change. So no triumphalism there. But let's go over to you, Adam Fleming, in Brussels. What is the mood like there?
Oh, very sombre. People are very sad indeed about the UK leaving, because they think Brexit is a historic mistake and they're going to lose the expertise, the influence, the political perspective of the UK, which many countries actually quite liked and quite often hid behind. And then there's the personal aspect that for lots of people here in the Brussels bubble, their British colleagues, people who they've become friends with and whose work they respected, are just going to disappear. Although, of course, the British presence won't disappear. The UK permanent representation is going to be renamed the UK mission to the EU. And later this afternoon, the European flag that hangs outside that building will be gently lowered, and it will only be the British flag that flutters there.
Yeah, we were hearing Ursula von der Leyen earlier on, the European Commission chief. She was, I suppose, trying to put a brave face on it. She was saying it's an emotional day, but now it's a story of old friends and new beginnings. And she said she's looking forward to the next stage. And that next stage is the fundamental one, full of bear traps, trying to reach this trade deal by the end of the year. Is your feeling there in Brussels that they're doggedly going to stick to their line and not give in to the demands of Britain?
Well, we'll get a very good idea about that on Monday next week, because Michel Barnier, who was the chief Brexit negotiator who negotiated the divorce deal, he's staying on to oversee the negotiations of the future relationship, which will have to cover trade, security, data protection, transport, you name it. And on Monday, he will publish a draft of his mandate, which will be his detailed blueprint for his objectives in the negotiation. And they will then have to be approved by the 27 member states before then the EU can actually sit round the table with the UK and hammer out the deal.
And Rob, in Westminster, Boris Johnson has got a huge parliamentary majority now, but he will be judged by what he gets out of that deal, won't he?
That's absolutely right. Look, Brexit is going from the sort of the abstract of the last 3.5 years to the practical, and it'll be judged by the same sort of rules of political gravity. Does it work? Is it good? And I'd put it this way, as you were saying, on the positive side for Mr. Johnson, he does have this whopping majority. He won an election. He leads a Conservative Party that is now united and is an out-and-out pro-Brexit party. On the other hand, you know, there are negatives, and the negatives are that there is no version of Brexit, according to the government's own forecasts, that won't be damaging to the economy, and that counts for a government that's promising to make people's lives better. And he will also be up against this, and that is that 50% of the population remains profoundly sceptical, businesses remain profoundly sceptical, historians, diplomats, and of course, most of Britain's allies continue to think of this as a mistake. So yes, some strength at home, but my goodness, what a challenge lies ahead.
That was Rob Watson, our London correspondent, and earlier we heard from Adam Fleming, our reporter in Brussels. Well, the 3 million or so EU citizens who call Britain their home have, until now, been able to live and work here freely. But Brexit ends this right. Well, one group of them this week decided to drown their sorrows, marking Brexit with a very British tradition, a pub crawl.
Brexit is upon us. A lot of EU citizens are really worried about what's going to happen. And we thought we can cry or we can laugh. And we decided against crying, and we thought we'd organise a pub crawl, the most British thing. It's a distraction. It's sad times for many people. So let's have some fun.
It's been very emotional because, as a Dutch person, to me, the European Union is a peace project. The Second World War was a horrendous thing, and there was a lot of talk afterwards about how can we prevent this. And so the leaders came together and basically said, well, the best way to prevent it is to make sure that everybody's economically linked so much that fighting with each other ever again would be a really stupid idea. Britain leaving the EU and leaving a peace project, to me, is heartbreaking.
For me, the most negative moment was going to the news agents and seeing, you know, headline about Romanians coming to steal the jobs. Because I felt like a Romanian, I was always considered a migrant.
We are part of communities throughout the UK, from London to the Highlands of Scotland. We are part of the country and we make this country tick. So I will continue to fight for that.
It's a group of EU citizens living in Britain, giving us their views on Brexit. More than 210 people dead and nearly 10,000 infected. The number of coronavirus cases worldwide has now surpassed that of the SARS epidemic of 2002 to 2003. Countries around the world are taking action to protect themselves and their citizens against the outbreak. Mongolia is going to close its border with China for nearly a month. Singapore has announced a sweeping ban on Chinese visitors and other foreigners who have been in the country in the past 14 days. And Italy has declared a state of emergency. The World Health Organization has praised China's openness, but has Beijing been completely transparent about the spread of the virus? I put that question to Michael Bristow, our Asia-Pacific editor.
Well, certainly the World Health Organization says that it's been really fulsome in its praise. I think this question should be broken into two bits. Firstly, the health section. I think China quite quickly did establish, its researchers established the nature of this virus and shared that scientific information with the World Health Organization and other researchers across the world. They've then been able to develop testing and hopefully in the future a vaccine for this virus. But the Chinese government wasn't always as open with its own people. There were many weeks in the beginning of January where there was no news about it, whereas the state-controlled media would relegate news about the virus to basically the end of a news bulletin. So people weren't really aware of what was going on, weren't panicking. An incident which has come to light just over the last couple of days is of eight people in Wuhan itself who tried to give information about the virus on social media. Not only were they stopped from doing that, they were detained by the police and told off. Now, the Supreme Court of China said that was wrong, that they should have been allowed to speak out. But you can see there has been a great deal of control on what the Chinese people have been receiving, what information they've been getting.
Yeah, so sometimes slow with information being given to people, but extremely quick now with infrastructure projects like the building of two hospitals in a couple of weeks. It's extraordinary. Perhaps only a country like China could do that.
I think you're right. Only an authoritarian country which has complete control over every aspect of life, if it chooses to. I mean, you only need to compare the building of those two hospitals with infrastructure projects here in Britain, the HS2, the high-speed rail line, which is ballooning costs and taking lots of time just to decide whether or not to even build it. It just shows you what China can do if it decides to. But perhaps it's worth noting that before they decided to act, there's an inertia in the system, something which the mayor of Wuhan has spoken about and which today the chief epidemiologist in China has spoken about as well, is that because everything's political, because there's such tight control, perhaps politicians don't act quickly enough and there's no one outside with authority to push them to act. So perhaps they are acting fast now, but were slow to get to that point.
That was our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow. A state of emergency has been declared in the Australian capital, Canberra, as a large wildfire threatens its southern suburbs. Australia has been battling fires for several months. Sharma Khalil reports.
Residents in the suburbs of Canberra have been urged to remain alert for potential evacuations. Andrew Barr, the chief minister of the Australian Capital Territory, has said the area is now facing the worst bushfire threat since the devastating blazes of 2003, which killed four people in the city and destroyed nearly 500 homes. The worst fire is currently burning just south of the district of Tuggeranong. Firefighters have been battling temperatures as high as 40 Celsius, along with strong winds and a tinder dry landscape.
Shaima Khalil. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend, you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
We'll be looking at the reaction to Donald Trump's long-awaited Middle East peace plan, unveiled this week as the president's legal team gave his defence at the impeachment trial in the Senate. We'll hear more on the economic impact of the coronavirus on China and the world. After 6 long months, India has restored some limited internet access for the people of Kashmir. But will that last? We'll also find out why the arrest of a Russian investigative journalist last year on drugs charges made police in Russia realise that this time they'd gone too far. And a historic moment as, after almost 50 years of membership, the UK bids adieu to the European Union. Or is it au revoir?
Thanks, Caroline. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
Please don't talk to me. You don't even know me. No, I don't want your number. Please stop talking to me. You're making me uncomfortable. Stop touching me. Get your grimy hands off of me.
How a new play in South Africa is tackling violence by men against women. As we record this podcast, President Trump's impeachment trial could soon be over. The Democrats appear to have failed in their efforts to persuade enough Republican senators to join them in calling for witnesses to be heard. Jannat Jalil got more from our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler.
Basically, the Democrats need to win 4 Republican votes. And they had been hopeful about one of the individuals who's known as Lamar Alexander. He is a Tennessee senator. They had been appealing to him, but he says he is not going to vote to hear witnesses. And that is going to be of great frustration to the Democrats. He has given in a statement a reason for that. He says that there is no doubt that there are concerns about the president's behaviour, but he doesn't feel it's up to Congress to remove a president. He says it is up to voters to decide who should be the president of the United States.
So this statement from Lamar Alexander, is this basically a death blow for the Democrats' hopes of calling witnesses, or could they get other Republicans to back them?
Well, they have got one Republican senator, Susan Collins, who's a senator from Maine, saying that she will vote with the Democrats on this issue of witnesses. They're hopeful about a couple of others as well. Mitt Romney has indicated he may well vote with the Democrats. Another, Lisa Murkowski, who's a senator in Alaska, she has also suggested that she hasn't decided yet whether or not she could vote with the Democrats, but it is a possibility. But fundamentally, they need 4. Even if they were to get all of those 3, it would be deadlocked 50-50 in the Senate. And ultimately then, it could depend, although we're in pretty uncharted territory here, but it could depend on the Chief Justice, the US Chief Justice, John Roberts, who is presiding over this trial, to cast a deciding vote. It is highly unlikely, I think, from what we're hearing, that he would do that. And if it was going to be a tied vote, it's probable that we wouldn't hear witnesses and could move to a final vote on whether to acquit or convict Donald Trump. So this impeachment trial could be over in the next 24 hours.
Chris Buckler, our Washington correspondent, speaking to Jannat Jalil. One of Pakistan's most prominent female beauticians says more needs to be done for women who suffer an acid or burn attack. Masarat Misbah founded a charity which has helped over 700 of them since 2003, and she's urged the authorities and the public to play a bigger role in the rehabilitation of these women. Our reporter Shabnam Mahmood has been to see the project in Lahore.
I was asleep. He came into the house and threw petrol over me. He locked the door from outside. I fainted and fell down, and my face was badly burnt.
6 years ago, Margaret's life changed after a violent attack by her husband left her in a coma.
I thought, why did this happen to me? I used to cry. I wanted to die so I could be set free. It was very difficult because when I looked into the mirror, I was scared of myself. I cried and cried.
It's estimated that around 1,500 women suffer from acid and burn attacks every year across the world, with the majority of cases in India, Bangladesh and Pakistan. The crime often goes unreported due to the social stigma or because it's committed by the victim's family members. Getting treatment for many women is even harder.
In Pakistan, because of our attitude of a society, male-dominated society, these things have been prevalent for as long as I can remember.
Masarat Misbah is a beautician turned philanthropist who's helped hundreds of women through her charity, the Depilex Smile Again Foundation.
People have started talking about this. There's a concern, there's a voice against this issue that, fine, you know, you're not happy in a marriage, do not throw acid on her, do not burn her. If she did not bring enough dowry, you know, divorce her.
Apart from helping them with their treatment, Masarat also gives the women work in her salons across Pakistan. Josephine has severe burns to her face and neck and has lost one of her eyes.
I come to the salon and I know I can't make myself beautiful, but I can make other women beautiful.
As well as being trained as beauticians, once a week, both Josephine and Margaret join other survivors in a class to learn new skills like baking. The women say it's helping them rebuild their lives.
It's useful because I can learn how to bake and I can then sell my products anytime to earn money.
I'm learning cooking and baking so I can work from home. I want to work hard and get back on my feet and support my children.
This is just a small step for these women, all of whom are on a long road to recovery.
Shabnam Mahmood with that report. Cervical cancer could be eliminated in countries worst affected by the disease, and 62 million lives could be saved over the next 100 years. That's according to research published in the medical journal The Lancet today. One of the report's authors is Professor Mark Brisson from Laval University in Canada.
It could be eliminated within the century. However, important targets have to be met, meaning that 90% of girls would have to be vaccinated, 70% of women would have to be screened twice in their lifetime, and 90% of women diagnosed with cervical cancer would have to receive the treatment that they need. We were looking at potential elimination in low- and middle-income countries. These countries have a high burden of cervical cancer. They represent probably about 90% of all the cases worldwide, so 90% of the 570,000 cervical cancer cases worldwide. And we looked at the conditions under which we could reach elimination, and we identified that, yes, high targets would have to be met to be able to do that, which would mean a considerable international financial and political commitment to achieve the goal.
Professor Mark Brisson of Laval University in Canada. A play is showing at the Pop Art Theatre in Johannesburg about three young women's experience of gender-based violence. It's called Text Me When You Arrive, How Not to Get Raped and Killed in South Africa. Bola Masoro found out more from one of the co-writers and performers, Tuli Duvane.
A lot of the stories that we share in the play are definitely drawn from our own lives, either from things that we've observed or things that we've gone through ourselves, absolutely. So the play is a very satirical, very physical exploration of the plight of women in South Africa every day. It's a sketch comedy sort of format, and it's about these three girls who make a YouTube channel giving girls tips on how to not get raped and killed in South Africa. And these three girls play it up very comedically, very clownish, and all the stories are kind of jam-packed in this comical, you know, physical storytelling kind of way. And in the end, it's, you know, quite a heavy piece to carry.
Okay, well, don't give the game away. You know, no spoilers here. But, you know, many people, when you say a satirical look on it, will think, God, that's a bit irreverent, isn't it? How can you be satirical about gender-based violence? But I believe you have a bit of a monologue to give us an example, a bit about when you were being catcalled, I believe.
Yeah. I wrote one of these monologues for the play, and it goes something like this. Things I wish I could say. Please don't talk to me. You don't even know me. Please don't touch me. You're making me uncomfortable. No, I don't want to smile at you. I don't want to talk to you. Leave me alone. I can afford my own drinks. I wouldn't be here if I couldn't. I didn't wake up this morning and squeeze myself into these jeans for you. And mind you, myself and these jeans has nothing to do with you. No, I don't want your number. Please stop talking to me. You're making me uncomfortable. Stop touching me. Get your grimy hands off of me. So, yeah, the way that we stage this is I'm standing in between, you know, the two other characters, and they play men who are groping me and touching me and like slow motion, and as something that many women have experienced, being groped on the streets after being catcalled because you're ignoring someone, you know?
Which is, you know, I mean, there are so many women around the world who would empathise with that, but it's more so. I mean, it's particularly hard in South Africa, isn't it? So much so that, you know, women have demanded, even the president does something about the level of gender-based violence in the country. Is this something that you've been thinking of for quite a while, the three of you?
Well, we devised and wrote the play in 2018 to give you, you know, that kind of context that it's been relevant then and it's still relevant now. And it's so sad that it feels like it will be relevant for a very long time. It is, the situation in South Africa is quite dire in terms of the statistics and how gender-based violence has just become worse and worse.
That was Tuli Duvane, a South African scriptwriter and actress, speaking to Bola Masoro. The boss of Britain's National Health Service has criticised the Hollywood actress Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand Goop and the associated Netflix series, The Goop Lab. Simon Stevens warned the brand is promoting treatments that carry considerable risks to health and says social media is fertile ground for quacks, charlatans and cranks. I got more from our reporter Farhana Dawood.
The NHS chief was speaking about myths and misinformation that he says have been put on steroids by the availability of misleading claims online. And he certainly did point out Gwyneth Paltrow and the Goop brand. It must be remembered that the Goop brand agreed to pay $120,000 in California for making unscientific claims about vaginal eggs. So, and that case was brought by the Californian Consumer Protection Office. So the NHS boss is really quite worried, in particular because there is a new Netflix series that Gwyneth Paltrow is currently appearing in. And in that series, the NHS boss says he was really scathing about some of the content. He says her team and the actress herself test vampire facials and back a body worker who claims to cure both psychological trauma and side effects by simply moving his hands above a customer's body. Now, here's a clip from that body worker.
You can measure the energy field of the body like somewhere between 4 and 6 feet off the body. The body doesn't end right here at the skin. The body is multidimensional. There are layers to it, and I'm interacting with those layers. So when I'm moving my hands in the air and I'm snapping my fingers and I'm making sounds with my hands, I'm putting energy into the field around somebody's body, and I'm changing their energy system just by the way I interact with it. The way we interact with someone without even touching them at the subatomic level changes them in some way, shape or form.
Well, that was John Amaral from the series. How has the Goop brand responded to all this criticism?
Well, they say that they take efficacy and product claims very seriously. They say the editorial and commercial aspects of their business is sometimes different in its approach, in that they take a different approach and different points of view. They say on the editorial side, they are transparent. And when they cover emerging topics that may be unsupported by science or maybe in the early stages of review, they say their products are available for retail sale and they have a robust legal and compliance team that works closely with science and research groups to vet product claims. Goop says we applaud the important work that the NHS does and often take our cues from the UK standard.
That was Farhana Dawood. Before we go, it's time now for news from elsewhere. Our weekly look at some of the less reported stories from around the world. In the studio with me now is Martin Morgan from our monitoring team, which follows global media in many languages. Martin, I believe there are some strange goings on in Iceland where the authorities aren't showing any sympathy for an attempt to name a child after the devil. How's all this come about?
Yeah, well, Iceland's one of those countries where you have to choose a name for your child from an official list. And if it's not on the list, then you need to go and apply to have it registered. Now, the idea is to stop people blighting their children's lives with weird or inappropriate names, and also to keep the names in line with the rules of the Icelandic language, which has barely changed for about 1,000 years. So when somebody tried to call their baby Lucifer, which is one of the names for the devil last year, they got a very firm no. Not only is it unfair on the child, the National Naming Commission says, but it also breaks the language rules. The Icelandic language doesn't have the letter C. Well, the enterprising parent has tried again, and he swapped the letter S for the letter C, but the Naming Commission still says no.
Fascinating stuff. Well, let's move from Iceland to Russia now, because I hear the winner of a beauty contest there may be less than overjoyed about her prize.
Yeah, that's right. Tatiana Day, which is the 25th of January, is a holiday for students in Russia. And one of the traditions is to choose a student called Tatiana to be queen of the ball. Now, out in Russia's Far East, the winner this year is a young woman called Tatiana Ostapenko. And her university decided to give her a special treat, an all-expenses-paid trip across the border to China, right in the middle of the coronavirus outbreak. Now, Russian social media has been having a bit of a ball of its own all about this, and they're making fun of the university and poor Tatiana herself with comments like, the prize must have been chosen for her by her rivals. Now, most people have been more sympathetic. And to be fair, the university has told her that it's going to offer her another prize as the coronavirus outbreak is clearly, you know, it's not going away.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Martin. Well, a very unfortunate young woman there. But thanks very much for bringing us those stories from elsewhere. And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is, as usual, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.